Thank you. And I'm really happy to be here. I do have to give you a caveat, though, that I do not have a magic wand for your hawkweed problems. So, sorry, but I can share some information from Oregon and Washington about the hawkweeds. We have their distribution, what we have been doing about it, some concerns about impacts of hawkweeds, and some remaining challenges. So hawkweeds in Oregon and Washington are relatively new compared to, say, Montana and Idaho, where they have thousands of acres of hawkweed. We have three primary species operating in Oregon. Do we have a pointer? There we go. So primarily orange hawkweed in really scattered locations here and there. One brand new infestation of mouse ear hawkweed, and then a really serious problem in the Blue Mountains with meadow hawkweed. But these only showed up in Oregon in the late 1980s, so relatively recent introduction, and Oregon Department of Ag was on top of it from the very beginning, wanting to try to keep them out. But both meadow and orange were introduced right here on the Mount Hood National Forest in a Bonneville Power Administration transmission line corridor. And there was some delays in treating that, but talk about that a little bit later. Then hawkweeds in Washington. So you all can look at this picture and think about the relatively close distance between Washington and Alaska. And there are so many species of hawkweed, invasive hawkweed in Washington now that they're mapping them by complex, not by species. So it's probably not showing up very well, but these are two maps of the subgenus groupings of invasive hawkweeds, not individual species. This one happens to be orange hawkweed, which first started a little bit earlier, like 1969 or so, right here in this corner of Washington. And again, that one was treated fairly early on, but it occurred in these homestead meadows that are used quite heavily in that part of the world for livestock grazing. And so the spread was, even though it was treated when found, was pretty difficult to manage. So why do we care about hawkweeds? I'm a wildlife biologist by training and got into the whole weed management realm because I saw invasive plants seriously impacting some endangered species in Southern California. And so that set my career on an entirely different path than what I had imagined. But this is one of my favorite quotes, really, from Bernd Blossi. Management of those invasive species that are able to dominate communities may not need further evidence to justify control. The invasion and displacement of native vegetation is the ecological disaster. And I agree wholeheartedly with that premise. But additionally, there have been some documented impacts from hawkweeds, loss of forage for elk and somewhat for deer is a big concern in our part of the world because the meadows and openings that the hawkweed invade are prime forage habitat for elk, and elk are kind of a big deal in our neck of the woods. Allelopathy, from hawkweed has been documented, exuding the chemicals that really do further exclude native plants. There have been some increased soil acidity measured under hawkweed infestations, and just their ability to dominate the landscape really can change the endemic natural beauty of native vegetation. Even though they might have pretty flowers, they really do alter the look of the land. And Australia has, unfortunately, some orange hawkweed taken off, and they've estimated potential losses of $48 million per year if it were to go unchecked and spread to its potential. So it has potential impacts in hay fields and other agricultural settings as well. And then on the conservation side, for sure, hawkweeds are freely hybridized, and they can hybridize with our native hawkweed species, which really pose a serious threat to the genetic integrity of those. Something that I think about in terms of these showy flower invasive plants, including hawkweeds, are what and how might they affect our native pollinators and the native plants that depend on pollination services and seed set from those pollinators. So it's been documented in some studies, not all, but some studies that invasive plants can obviously alter the native plant diversity and density, but also reduce the population and diversity of associated pollinators on those native plants. Invasive plants could also be a population sink for native pollinators. In this study by, by Graves and Shapiro, they documented that invasive plant attracted two species of native butterflies, and they laid their eggs on the invasive plants, but the invasive plants were toxic to the larvae. So even though it was an attractant, and some people might say, oh, well, the native pollinators are using them, so that it must be okay, it's not okay. It's actually a death trap for those native pollinators. And competition for pollinators, again, the more showy flowers, perhaps more pollen, more nectar from the invasive can draw pollinators away from natives, and in some cases has been documented to cause reduced seed set in the native plants growing in proximity to the invasive. So that's the kind of thing that concerns me with hawkweeds taking off. If we were to allow them to just take off, give up the ghost or whatever, could this set us up for some cascading effects in our ecosystems? We certainly don't have the data to draw any conclusions about that yet, but it's the kind of thing that I worry about as a biologist and an invasive plant program manager. So given the food theme of this talk, what about native food plants, especially up here in Alaska? Berries are huge, right? For all kinds of berries, all kinds of reasons. And they depend on native pollinators to help form those berries and pollinate those flowers. What might be potential implications there? We don't know. I'm not aware of any specific study. Katie?
I have 4 years research on it.
Awesome.
It's interesting. It goes on
scale. Yes, of course. Yeah. So that is the problem that I always try to communicate with folks, is that if we allowed our invasive plants and non-native plants to get so big and such a large extent that we actually can measure specific ecological effects, it is far too late for us to realistically do anything about it. So that's another reason I like Bernd Blossi's quote, is like, just displacing the native vegetation is all we need to know to go after these things. That's So what have we been doing in the PNW, Pacific Northwest, our little corner of it? We're not all of it. But one example is we got some mouse ear hawkweed infestations in Mount St. Helens, and National Volcanic Monument, and many of you are probably familiar with Mount St. Helens, and as people familiar with invasive species challenges, you can imagine the challenge of managing invasive plants on a landscape that is that disturbed on that scale. And we certainly have that challenge at Mount St. Helens. But the mouse ear hawkweed was taking over some meadows that are important for elk, and that's a whole other interesting story about how rapidly elk recolonized Mount St. Helens after the eruption. It's really quite fascinating, but that elk herd is a big deal for a whole lot of reasons. And so Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation actually funded and has funded for several years, repeatedly contributed to these mouse ear hawkweed treatments. So that's great. These treatments were treated with clopyrrolid at about a pint per acre plus non-ionic surfactant. And like several issues we have had, the treatment is very successful. So here's just 1 year later. We can't even see any rosettes in here from all of this flowering mouse ear hawkweed. And then, you know, later on in the year, we find these little teeny patches, but lots of regrowth of the grass and other native plants. So that was good. Mount Hood is the location where we had the first introduction of the mouse ear, orange and meadow hawkweed in Oregon on this transmission line corridor. And this is an interesting story because these big transmission line corridors, the primary purpose for the vegetation management under them is to make sure that vegetation doesn't grow tall so that it could arc and cause outages and fires. And so early on, if they introduced a low-growing invasive plant like hawkweed, they didn't really care, right? It wasn't in their wheelhouse, really. So it has taken a lot of years of conversation and work to manage the infestations along these corridors. And as Bill said, partnerships are the key. There were a lot of interested entities. These transmission line corridors cross a lot of different land jurisdictions. And everybody was sort of doing their own thing or not doing anything, and it took quite a while to get everybody on the same page. But now they have a really good defined meeting frequently, a couple times a year. All of these entities meet to discuss specifically the management of hawkweed in those corridors, and that has greatly improved the success of the treatments. And we still have some challenge getting Bonneville Power Administration on board, but part of that has to do with their funding cycles. So understanding the mission of your partner agencies and how their funding cycles work is actually really crucial to helping make partnerships successful. And unfortunately, the hawkweeds up there have skipped out of some of the power line corridors and into our wilderness areas nearby, but we're going after those as well. This is Glenn Miller with Oregon Department of Ag. He's been like the chief hawkweed killer in the state for a long time. Again, the treatments have been successful, but there's still some challenges remaining. And then just a brief mention from my colleague friend Todd Neal, who did work for the Park Service until we stole him for the Forest Service, which was a coup on our part. But for years he was on the exotic plant management team for the Park Service and probably killed more invasive plants than all of us in this room put together. But Mount Rainier National Park successfully eradicated yellow hawkweed, a complex of yellow hawkweed species, on the Nisqually to Paradise Road using clopyrrolid and aminopyrrolid. But as Todd says, it took years of ground crews wandering aimlessly up the road. And that's a very key component to success. You'll see in the next one, not so successful, around the New Halem area in Washington, they got 95% control of yellow hawkweed in a mixed conifer after the first treatment, but then they declined to follow up on it. And so, you know, several years later, it's back to a huge monoculture. And that is not an efficient use of money, resources, or anything else. So what are some of the challenges that we still continue to face? And these will be familiar to you, I'm sure, but this is one of the biggest. These are all invasive yellow hawkweed species in the state of Washington. So coming soon to an area near you, right? And they can be confused because our native hawkweeds are yellow as well. And so there is some risk of hybridization, and also you want to be careful in your treatments. But the native ones don't tend to form these big, dense mats of solid hawkweed. That's not the behavior that they have. Spread, continued spread. Again, this is a power line corridor right next to a road on the Mount Hood National Forest. The seeds of these species are produced sexually and asexually. That's a bummer. The seeds contain, the surface of them contain those tiny little barbs that are really good to stick on things, making them perfect for spread. And they don't need scarification or anything. They can germinate as soon as they hit the ground and remain viable in soil for 7 years. And the plant also spreads vegetatively by stolons and spreads out. So in some ways, it's like the perfect weed, right? It spreads every way possible for a weed to spread, and it's quite successful at doing so. Yeah, so the plants themselves, I say, are easy to kill but hard to manage. They're quite responsive to a suite of herbicides that we have available to us that are very low toxicity and in some cases quite selective. So that's a good thing. But all of those other attributes of the plant still make it difficult to manage. And I think we tend to fail most often on that follow-up phase and the real hunt and peck search. You know, as the natives grow back and you have just a couple plants here and there, that's the really difficult part of managing an infestation. For us, geography is a big problem. You can't really tell it, but this power line corridor is very steep. And we have this cool little critter that's only found in our part of the world. It's called a mountain beaver, Aplodontia rufa. And it's a little bit smaller than a nutria, and it likes to dig these big holes. So when you're walking up a very steep corridor with 30 pounds of herbicide on your back, and you risk stepping in one of these, they're colloquially, they're called boomers. So these are boomer holes. So stepping in a boomer hole in that situation is a recipe for a broken leg. So we have to have spotters go with our applicators just to look for the boomer holes. And then some of our areas, you might, in this part of the world, this is probably a pretty unusual situation, but we have areas that are a long, long way from water. And so getting water to be able to treat is an issue. And in the case of Mount St. Helens, we actually got enough funding 1 year to stage these, what we call pumpkins, in remote areas so that we could fill the backpacks and continue treating some of the infestation. And that was a little spendy, as they say in Oregon. So what do we need? Obviously, nothing new to you folks, but I think the prevention, and Bill alluded to this as well, the spread issue, I think, remains some of our biggest challenges, particularly for hawkweeds. Treatment, you know, we can kill it, but the prevention is problematic. And as you folks know, enlisting partners to be effective is absolutely crucial. Get them while they're small, and don't neglect that many years of follow-up and extra search time that's required to manage it. So thank you.